UST. Together, we build for boundless impact.
The Fed removes a U.S. recession from its forecast. We'll look at whether GDP numbers will back up that view. Plus, a coup in Niger threatens a key bulwark against terrorism, and U.S. allies snub natural gas from a new pipeline in Alaska.
With Japan and South Korea, the region's two largest LNG importers, aside from China, not on board, this is a significant roadblock for the project going forward.
It's Thursday, July 27th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The Fed raised rates yesterday. That much was expected. But what was less expected was this announcement by Chairman Jerome Powell.
So the staff now has a noticeable slowdown in growth starting later this year in the forecast. But given the resilience of the economy recently, they are no longer forecasting a recession.
That marks a notable shift in the U.S. economic forecast after Fed staff in March, May, and June forecast that a recession would likely begin this year. And while Powell says he's not using the word optimism yet, there are signs that a soft landing in which the Fed can contain inflation without tipping the economy into recession could be in play. Alex Frangos is Wall Street Journal finance editor, and he joins me now with the very latest. Alex, from what we've just heard, it seems the U.S. economy really has defied expectations lately, and we are about to get U.S. GDP figures this morning, the broadest measure of growth out there. Are we expecting that data to confirm that sort of rosier assessment?
Yeah, it's funny how the Fed manages to make a rosier assessment sound really boring, but this is something that a lot of economists and investors have been noticing for a little while now, that the economy has just been way more resilient. There's still plenty of jobs. People are earning more money. They're still spending money. We saw that with the previous quarter's growth surprising on the upside and expecting solid growth again, which is pretty amazing considering that interest rates have gone up basically from 0 to 5% in warp speed. And nobody, if you had asked them a year ago if the economy could withstand such a huge increase, would have said, oh yeah, it'll be fine. The economy will still be growing. There'll still be jobs. Everything will be fine. So yeah, big surprise.
In terms of that shift in sentiment yesterday, and yes, albeit not the most gripping soundbite, though consequential it certainly was, have markets mostly baked that assessment in, or should we expect them to react positively to the abating signs of a U.S. recession?
The funny thing is with markets, they're almost not even listening to Jerome Powell. The Fed came to this conclusion yesterday, probably markets came to this conclusion 6 weeks ago or longer, and they're starting to look beyond the growth may be holding up okay to how much will growth slow and when will the Fed start cutting rates. The classic cycle in the economy is the Fed raises rates to slow inflation and invariably it does too much and the economy goes into recession. The alternative, really rosy scenario, is the soft landing. And that's what the Fed was predicting in its forecast yesterday, is that we'll get a slowdown in growth, but not a contraction in growth. And so that's what markets are kind of trying to figure out.
All right, let's shift from the U.S. to Europe, the European Central Bank, today announcing its latest rate decision. I'm curious just what their likely move is, but also what is their outlook going to be? Is it going to sound anything like what we've been hearing from the U.S.?
Europe is, you could think of it as a step behind the U.S. in this whole cycle. They were slower to raise rates. Inflation has been slower to come down. It's still quite high, and there's still a wariness. I think what the ECB is going to do, they're going to definitely raise rates today, and people will be looking for signals of what they'll do at the next meeting in September. But there's so much water to go under the bridge between then and now, and it's really on a razor's edge as to whether they need to keep going, keep raising rates, or whether they take a pause.
The good old August recess. It's about to get quiet here in Europe. I forgot about that, but thanks for the reminder. Alex Frangos, Wall Street Journal finance editor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And let's stay in Europe for a moment and bring in another journal editor, Chip Cummins, who has been watching the flurry of big corporate earnings that have come in this morning. Chip, there is a lot on the docket today, including Mondelez, AbbVie, McDonald's, but it is Nestle, the world's largest packaged food company, that perhaps tells us the most, namely about inflation, where it's going, how consumers are responding to it. They've reported earnings this morning. What did we hear?
Well, Nestle's following a number of big consumer goods companies, Coca-Cola, for instance, earlier this week, and Unilever, which makes Ben & Jerry's ice cream, saying that they're continuing to be able to raise prices without a significant drop in volume. So that means people are still buying their stuff, even though the prices are going up in some cases quite a bit. Now, the price inflation isn't as high as about this time last quarter, but it's still certainly high in the 9 to 10% range. Nestle today said they had raised prices in North America by 10%. From the year ago period, which is still quite significant.
Is it clear how sustainable this sales volume is going forward, especially in light of those price increases?
These companies are saying so far they are cautious. Unilever earlier this week said they were seeing some fall off, especially in the U.S., in terms of consumer demand. But for right now, they've been able to hold prices up, which have helped sales stay up and profits.
Good news for those companies, though not great news if, as consumers, we're hoping for some abatement in price increases.
Yeah, absolutely. The Fed and central banks around the world are trying to keep prices down. So optically, it's not great. There has been some political pushback in places like the UK and France, attempts to try to rein in companies' price increases without actually setting price caps or anything extreme like that.
That was European business editor Chip Cummins. Chip, thank you.
Thank you.
The European Union has opened an antitrust investigation into Microsoft, its first into the company in more than a decade. The bloc's executive body, the European Commission, said it's concerned that Microsoft may be giving its Teams video conferencing app an unfair advantage by not allowing customers to choose whether access to the product is included when they subscribe to the company's productivity software. A Microsoft spokesman said it will continue to cooperate with the commission and said it's committed to finding solutions that address its concerns. For more on this developing story, head to WSJ.com. A group of military officers in the West African country of Niger say they have removed the country's elected president. According to people close to the president, disgruntled guards encircled the president's residence in the early hours of Wednesday morning before a group called the National Council for the Salvation of the Fatherland seized power. Our Africa Bureau Chief Gabriel Steinhauser says this developing situation could have significant consequences, not least because Niger is seen as one of the most reliable U.S. allies in the fight against Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, and Boko Haram.
We don't actually fully understand yet what is happening in Niger. If this coup is successful, it will place pretty strict limitations on what the US can do to continue helping Niger in fighting Islamists, because there are legal restrictions in the US on military aid to countries that have governments that came to power through a coup. The US is obviously trying to fight these militants in these countries, but the US at the same time is also concerned about the growing Russian influence in the region. So, for instance, Mali and Burkina Faso, who themselves have had military coups against elected governments in recent years, they have grown closer to the Russians. And Niger, for the US, is really seen as this kind of firewall against both the spread of Islamists and also at the same time a close U.S. and Western ally in the region.
For the second time this week, Russia has attacked a U.S. drone in the skies over Syria. Yesterday, U.S. officials said that a Russian jet had dropped flares that damaged the wing of an American Reaper drone, resembling an incident on Sunday that officials believe is part of a concerted Russian effort to pressure the U.S. military to pull back from Syria. National security correspondent Michael Gordon says the attacks are raising fears of escalation in Washington.
This recalls a similar episode in March where Russian planes harassed a U.S. drone over the Black Sea and damaged its propeller, and that U.S. reconnaissance drone crashed. So tensions are heating up. They've stopped short of direct hostilities, with the exception of a November episode in which the Russians fired a surface-to-air missile at a U.S. drone. They haven't shot at each other, but the Russians have been very aggressive in the air, and this is causing great concern at the Pentagon.
A Russian military official blamed the U.S. for Wednesday's incident, saying the American drone had made a dangerous approach toward Russian jets, prompting a defensive response. And the House Judiciary Committee is today expected to vote on whether to hold Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg in contempt of Congress unless he turns over company documents. WSJ reporter Ryan Tracy says the Republican-led push is part of a long-running debate about the proper relationship between government officials and social media companies.
They are trying to prove that social media companies and the government work together to censor conservative speech. They've certainly found evidence that the government and social media companies work very closely together sometimes. For example, on COVID-19, the Biden White House was heavily pressuring Facebook to remove what the White House saw as false information about vaccines and the like. And Facebook at times appeared to be very much looking to the government to decide what was true or false. This is based on emails that have been released as the House probe and also some lawsuits by state's attorneys general here. Now, whether that amounts to censorship is in the eye of the beholder.
Meta says its content moderation decisions are independent and not made with regard to politics. Coming up, the U.S. is telling its allies in Asia that a new Alaskan natural gas pipeline could deliver them energy security. So why aren't they lining up to back it? We've got that story and more after the break.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
We are exclusively reporting that America's allies in Asia have turned down offers from Washington to invest in a new natural gas pipeline in Alaska. The Journal's River Davis reports that potential buyers and investors from Japan and South Korea have rebuffed U.S. overtures to attach themselves to one of the biggest energy investments in American history. And River joins me now from Tokyo with the very latest on this story. River, we haven't talked here about the Alaska LNG project in a long time, if we've talked about it at all. Remind us about the basics of this.
So this project has been in the works for more than a decade in various iterations. But basically, the latest on the project is they're envisioning a pipeline transporting natural gas from these gas and oil fields in the northern slope of Alaska, which is above the Arctic Circle. That pipeline will extend 800 miles south to the Kenai Peninsula, where a very small town called Nikiski, Alaska, will house a liquefaction plant for that natural gas. And from that facility, it will be loaded onto cargo ships that eventually would make it to Asia if the project moves forward.
And there are some broader U.S. geopolitical objectives behind this whole project, too.
Yeah, so this project actually looked like it was stalling around 2019. The company that was running it essentially said they were scaling back activities while they were looking at whether or not it was feasible or not. And then, of course, last year we had a huge supply crunch globally when it came to gas. And that kind of rejuvenated efforts to get this project off the ground. So we had officials in Alaska and also diplomats operating here in Asia pitching this project as a way to actually get allied nations in Asia off of Russian gas and oil. So Japan and Korea and some other countries in the region still rely on imports of Russian gas to keep businesses operating, keep lights on. So this was kind of a renewed effort on the U.S.'s part to both get this, you know, more than $40 billion project off the ground and also help allies in the Asia region switch away from Russian energy.
And yet, in spite of that all-out diplomatic push, it sounds like American officials got kind of a muted reception on these overseas trips. Why was that?
That's right. So speaking to people, some of the biggest energy importers in South Korea and Japan, there is interest in natural gas and creating these new purchase contracts, but they needed the timeline to be sooner. So right now they see kind of this crunch in LNG extending for the next 3-4 years. So they really want gas now. They want to sign contracts now. And this project in Alaska looks like it won't be exporting any sooner than around 2030. And the other issue is that there's a bit of skepticism out of companies here and from government officials here about whether or not the project will actually get off the ground. So essentially, they're afraid that they'll commit to purchasing gas from this project, it won't move forward, and then they'll lose out on other opportunities to sign contracts with other companies and with other projects in other regions of the world.
River, you noted in your reporting that both South Korea and Japan continue to import Russian liquefied natural gas. Does this lack of enthusiasm about the Alaska LNG project perhaps signal a desire on their part to continue buying from Russia? And if so, does it maybe tell us something about the larger Western effort to try and reduce reliance on Russia?
What we hear from government officials here and major energy companies here as well is that they are looking to replace Russian supplies. So a lot of the contracts in Japan, for example, are set to phase out around the end of this decade. And so there is a significant effort happening at the moment in Japan looking at other projects that they can fill gaps in Russian supply with. So there's interesting projects coming online in Canada, in the Gulf Coast of the U.S., and of course in the Middle East. Australia is another example. So there is intent to move away from Russian gas and oil, but whether or not that will be Alaska is a different question.
Finally, River, you mentioned this Alaska LNG project has effectively stalled before. Could that happen again if these struggles to recruit buyers, investors continues?
We spoke with Alaskan Senator Sullivan recently, who said this project is closer than ever to getting off the ground. It has significant backing from the Biden administration. It got the green light from the Energy Department in April. So it is set to go. The last piece he is looking at is just getting this private sector interest. So that means signing purchase agreements with countries. And as far as they're saying at the moment, they are only targeting Asia. So with Japan and South Korea, the region's two largest LNG importers, aside from China, not on board, this is a significant roadblock for the project going forward.
That was the Journal's River Davis in Tokyo. River, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
And finally, the River Seine flows through the heart of Paris, and its banks are a great place to bring a baguette and a bottle of wine. And soon, you might consider packing a bathing suit in your picnic basket as well. That's because thanks to a $1.4 billion regeneration project, the once heavily polluted river will soon be safe enough for people to swim in after a century-long swimming ban. Paris even plans to host events in the Seine during next year's Summer Olympics in what it hopes could be one of the major legacies of the Games. WSJ reporter Noemi Biserb explains how the city managed to fix its dirty water and whether other cities will follow suit.
Well, it's been pretty hard because obviously, like many rivers, the River Seine is polluted by industrial and domestic sewage. And the challenge in Paris is that the city has a combined sewer system. That means that if it rains heavily, the system gets saturated and the excess has to be drained into the Seine. And so what the city has done is that they've built these big underground reservoirs, which will store the runoff in times of heavy rain. And that should allow the river to remain clean enough for swimming. Other cities have already started this process. You can already swim in some cities in Northern Europe. And, well, we can only hope that this will inspire other cities to do the same.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.